Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ken Hudson Show. Ken has investigated the strange and unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us into tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show right here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio. Coming to you live from our studios in El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we've got a interesting show for you tonight. Carla, I hate to tell you that Ted is not going to be here. He was on last night. He's got a schedule conflict, something going on in New York. So I'm going to talk about some strange and unusual places. The second hour, we have Robert McKnight, who will be with us for just the second hour, but he's going to be doing readings for those who call in. And then, of course, during the third hour, more strange tales. Well, I just didn't want you to be disappointed, Carla. Now, you know, it's interesting that whenever we talk about, you know, the strange and unusual, some of the very odd things that happen. Number one, you know, I've been chasing ghosts and reading and researching and what have you, this field, since I guess I was about 10 when I really got serious about it. And I've been doing ghost tours. You threw on me. Oh. I tend to have that effect, kind of like fungus. And I've been doing ghost tours for about 10 years, showing people the haunted places in this area. And, you know, long before Ghost Hunters was thought about, I was going into strange and unusual places and seeing what I could find. And when I started doing the ghost tours seriously, of course, everyone laughed at me. They said I was dumb to be wasting my time, that nobody was going to want to pay me to show them haunted places. Now, I wasn't the first one to do tours here. The first one started about 20 years ago, as far as I'm aware. And they did them, I think, once or twice a month. And they about broke even, I guess. I wrote books about haunted places and, you know, some of the unsolved mysteries. And when I started doing that, people laughed at me. They're never going to get published. Nobody's going to buy them. Yada, 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 yada. The interesting thing is the general public loved them, the books and the tours. And of course, when it appeared that it was making a fortune, and it wasn't, let me assure you, because I would make sure that everyone got a meal where I would talk about the tales of hauntings, and then after the meal was over, we would go on our tour. Now, the meal was included in the ticket price. And something I discovered that was quite interesting, there are people who believe they own history. Now, there was a group of reenactors that I wanted to be part of, and I joined and supported. And that's when I found out there are certain cliques in this town that literally, if they can't get a nickel, if you make a dime and they can't get a nickel of it, they're going to fight you like a tiger to keep you from succeeding. And not only to me, but they've chased more business out of this town than most cities ever have the opportunity to ever see. Now, this is considered one of the poorest cities in the state of Texas. And yet, SeaWorld was going to build here, a big facility, bigger than the one they've got in San Antonio. And the mayor at the time wanted his real estate company to sell the land. And they already had their land picked out, a deal already done. So he said, you buy it from me or you hit the road. They hit the road. A number of major corporations have wanted to come in here and build big facilities. This was the garment capital of the country for many, many years. Levi, all the big companies were here. Of course, Bill Clinton and NAFTA took care of that. 50,000 lost jobs in a little over a year. And I was there watching it happen. I was vice president, general counsel of one of the big companies that created jobs that are disabled, no less. And it was making too much money for the powers that be to overlook it, so they came in and it became a major mess. I tried to oppose it, and I was told that I'd get on board or I'd leave, and I left. And even though what they were doing was illegal, that was okay because the right people were getting their palms greased. Well, I was now retired, and I was growing my little, you know, ghost tour business. And a woman who still believes that she owns a historic cemetery wanted initially 10% of what I brought in as a donation. Well, she was involved in the reenactment group, and I donated the money to buy tents and all kinds of other stuff. And then she wanted half. She was entitled to half. And finally, she wanted it all. She would allow me to go in to a public cemetery and do my tours if I gave all the money to her. And I said, well, if you want to get out here in the heat and walk around and do these tours, we can talk. Another lady wrote a book about the cemetery, and she was approached and told that she should donate everything she made on the book to the cemetery. In other words, to this woman who thinks she owns it. And That didn't work. One of the members, the guy who thinks he owns the reenactment group, became the head of the historical commission here in town. Runs around dressed and with his hair cut like Buffalo Bill. He went and found somebody and backed him with not only the reenactment group, but money from the cemetery, the group that oversees the cemetery, to be my competition. Now, they got an interesting way of being competitive. In the normal world, I have my product, you have your product, and it's whichever one the public likes. But that was too iffy for them. Cat Star has joined us. How are you? Hope you're having fun in Australia. So he went and charged half of what I charged, because he was being supplemented on the backside by these groups. Then he pretended to be me in order to get his business jump started, because I would talk about it on my show. I'd do a tour, and he'd run out there and be waiting for people who showed up looking for me and say he was me, because, you know, unless you sit very close to the radio, you can't tell what I look like. Then that wasn't enough for him, so he decided that he'd let me out of the cemetery so that he'd be the only one that could do the tours. First time he tried it, he had an armed guard with a shotgun, and I informed the guard he could get out of my way or I would show him how easily that shotgun could be inserted. He got out of the way. The next time they tried that little stunt, they threatened to have me around. I'm a 100% disabled veteran. I walk with a cane. He had someone physically assault me and then threatened to arrest me for being on public property. So I took him to the county commission here, which actually that is county property. The county, unfortunately, while agreeing with me, put a condition on it that makes it impractical for me to continue to do the tours. You see, the county doesn't want there to be problems. So they require that you pay for 3 hours of a security guard at $20 an hour. He has his supplemented by the cemetery people. They paid the $20. And he supposedly donates every nickel to the cemetery. Well, his mask's a little different than most people's. If he has 200 people show up, somehow that becomes 50. And that's what he turns over. And nobody ever questions him because he's a fine, upstanding individual. And they see nothing wrong with this. Now, they don't bother to stop and think, because I heard his first tour. He didn't know what I looked like. And it was like listening to someone read my book that I had out at that time. And then it got so bad, people started referring to him as Mini-Me. And it's somebody who wants to be me so bad he can taste it. And I don't understand why. I've worked damn hard to get to this point. And unfortunately, he wants to push me out of the way to take over without having to do all the work. So what they have done now is forced me to take them back to the county commission to deal with this issue of the security. Now, I put the county on notice that if I'm attacked again, this time I will respond. And then I will sue the county and he for conspiracy. Apparently, it's okay to lie, cheat, and steal to get ahead, at least in his mind. He even does a show. And his idea of good radio is to laugh about other people, run them down, cuss, because that makes him cool, you know. And he slipped and let it be known he listens to me every night, and that's how he knows it, that I say things about him. Well, I don't think I've ever mentioned his name on my show. If I did, I'd have to go wash my mouth out with soap. Number two, he and the whole group he runs with are wannabes. The woman that runs the cemetery in the reenactment group insists on playing a 19-year-old, and she's got to be 60 if she's a day. Old Buffalo Bill, who runs the reenactment group, if you disagree with the way he does it, he runs you out of it. And he and his wife are offended that someone else might not agree with the way they do things and might want to have their own group. You know, unfortunately, I'm not related to anybody here, and this is a this city firmly believes in the theory of relativity. If you're related to folks, you get ahead. If you don't, screw you. We got some of the crookedest officials that have ever walked down the pike. We got a congressman who is so afraid of bad publicity that if you say something he doesn't like, he has your show taken off of regular radio. He hadn't yet figured out how to attack the internet. If anybody ever looked into some of his shenanigans, it would definitely be interesting. But he's one of the Democrats who worships at the feet of Lord Obama. And thanks to Pelosi, he's gotten to the bigger heights. If you know what the Peter Principle is, you get promoted to your level of incompetence. He has gone far beyond that. And what's so silly is he went out of his way to pick a fight with me, and I know where the bodies were buried, and I know what kind of payoffs he got from a certain individual here in town. And if he annoys me again, I'm going to start naming names on the air. You know, it's so sad. I'm just wanting to be left alone to do my show. And you may wonder why I've gone off on a tirade tonight. Didn't intend to, but there's been so much in the way of opposition and stumbling blocks thrown in front of me. I was honored by the library. They put my name on the front window, but along with a lot of other authors from this town. And somebody, I'm not going to say who, went down and shot that window out. Now, I don't know why I'm looked at as such a threat to certain people. You know, they say imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, and I'm the most flattered person in town because I got people pretending to be me. And nobody seems to want to step in and do anything about it. I'm waiting for him to publish my books under his name. I've made it clear any more attacks will result in me defending, and he doesn't want me to do that. He really doesn't want me to do that. I have put up with all of his silliness. I'm going to. And he can get his brother-in-law, the fat little guy who chest bumped me the last time and got up in my face, and then he's going to do this and he's going to do that. And I invited him to come on. I even offered him time on my show to explain their rationale for what they're doing. But he has a reputation, both of them have reputations of being major cowards. And they've got folks that they run high behind their skirts every time they do some of this crap. Well, no more hiding. You come after me again, and we bring in war back to the South. I assure you. Carla asked if I got a good lawyer. I is one. Or I was before I retired. And I'd hope never to have to deal with that sleazy environment again. But unfortunately, to give you an idea of the legal profession in this town, I went to a very prominent attorney. Front pew of the church, walks about 2 inches above the pavement. Oh, he's God's gift to the law. And I had a case that his partner agreed was an outstanding case. Well, after agreeing to take it, turned me down because the guy I was going to sue had offered to fund the children's hospital they wanted to put in this town and put him on the board. In other words, he was bought off. And he's one of the most outstanding attorneys who's ever drawn a breath. But that's okay, because he did it for a good cause. And speaking of the children's hospital, now, there was a children's hospital already in one of the hospitals in this town. And they wanted to put another one. And they put a campaign on that you wouldn't believe. In this town, if you want to get something passed, tie it to children and start wringing your hands and jumping up and down on radio and TV that it's for the children. If you turn down what they want, then you're anti-children. And they went on even my show and said that the new children's hospital would not cost the taxpayers one solitary cent. It'd be self-funding from the get-go. Now, I came up through the old school, and that math just didn't make sense to me, but I was told I was just too dumb to know how to breathe, to dare doubt these brilliant people. So it went on the ballot, and of course, the people of El Paso wanting to help the children passed it. Bonds were sold to raise $100 and some odd million. Now remember, it wasn't going to cost taxpayers a nickel. Self-funding from the get-go. About 6 months later, the city council said, well, it's time to start paying back, retiring those bonds, so we're going to raise taxes. It's not going to cost taxpayers a nickel. And one person said to me, were you really dumb enough to believe that? Then there's four school districts in this town, each one with multiple administrators. And they, the smallest school district, 40,000 people, or 40,000 students, went in to the voters asking for $400 million. 40,000 students, they wanted $400 million. It's for the children. If you say no, you're condemning the children to substandard education, yada, 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 yada. Luckily, the voters wised up and said, are you out of your mind? Well, the superintendent got fired because she couldn't get the $400 million. But my point is, that's how things go in this town. Now, people who have been on both tours say that they enjoy mine very much. Because if you question anything Mini-Me says, he'll go into a temper fit. How dare you question him? He's a celebrity. But I think it's about time to bring all this stuff to a screeching halt. There's another guy in town who does radio shows, a good friend of mine. One of his associates made a video, and he chose Mini-Me to be his ghostly advisor. What I was annoyed about was they used information out of my books and they didn't even mention my name. And all these people look at me as an enemy and I haven't done a thing to them. Instead of coming to me like men and saying, here's what we want to do. You got a problem? They run around behind my back and they backstab and they make deals with people. Not a one of them's got the integrity to come up to me face to face and say, let's sit down and talk about this. Mini-Me keeps wanting to resolve our differences and bury the hatchet. I wasn't aware we had a hatchet except the one he keeps trying to put in my back. And one minute he wants to bury the hatchet, and the next minute he wants to go on the attack. I have no idea what the hell's going on. Now, all that having been said, a lot of the hacking and problems that we've had on this show originated with him and some of his sidekicks before it got a life of its own. So the only thing we can do is the best we can do. Carla's got a good sense of humor. All right. Until Robert joins us, and that'll be in about 30 minutes, let's talk a little bit about a topic I'm asked about quite often, and that's ghosts and children. You know, a lot of kids have imaginary playmates. And quite often, they bring them to the dinner table. They require a place to be set for them. And sometimes they even furnish information they say came from their imaginary playmate. You know, about 1 in 3 people never admit they've seen a ghost. But in actuality, if we recognized every ghost that we see, the number would probably be far higher. Because quite often these apparitions are so lifelike, they're mistaken for real people. And some witnesses just simply don't remember their ghostly encounters. And those people I'm referring to are children. It's been estimated that probably 30% of the imaginary friends may well be ghosts. And while as a child you interact with them every day, as you grow older, sometimes you forget. Now, at the top of the list of spirits that have been seen by children seems to be grandparents. A lot of parents have reported that their babies and toddlers seem to be interacting with grandparents who died even before the child was born. Sometimes giggling and sometimes calling them by special nicknames the child had no way to know. Carla says, I believe my grandnephew would see my mom all the time when he was still wee. They had a funky bond over the light fixture in the dining room when he was a baby. 18 months when her mother died, he would look up at the picture and laugh many months later. Sounds reasonable. Now, assuming there is life after death, certainly a grandparent's going to want to see their grandchild. And children don't realize when they see that imaginary playmate, which is actually a grandparent or some other relative, that what they're seeing is, to many people, impossible. The older they get, the ability to interact with this special friend seems to fade away. One of the reasons seems to be that they're told routinely by the adults not to make up stories. Now, there was a story that I read that took place on the first day of school, and this young lady was running late. She was about 7 or 8 at the time. And while her mother was yelling hurry, she ran into the bathroom to brush her hair. She flipped on to the right and reached for the hairbrush, looked in the mirror, and froze. Because standing behind her in the shower was a girl she'd never seen before. Now, the girl was smiling. She wore a nightgown and had auburn hair. She turned around and looked in the shower to see who it was, and of course, there was nobody there. So she turned back and looked in the mirror, but the girl could still be seen in the mirror. And as she watched The figure in the mirror said, "Hi." Well, the real girl dropped a hairbrush and got out of there in a hurry. Her mother was standing by the front door, tapping her foot, as parents tend to do when children are dallying. And the girl told her she'd just seen, you know, what she had seen. And, you know, the mother, who was, of course, in a rush to get her children to school on time, didn't want to hear make-believe stories. Now, when she told the story to the person who got it to me, she said it, at the time she had seen this girl, she did have an imaginary friend, and the mother assumed, wrongly, that it was her imaginary friend she was talking about. Now, by the time she got around to telling the story to someone other than her mother, she was a little bit older, and she made it clear she knew the difference between an imaginary friend and an apparition. The girl in the mirror was real, and she can remember and describe her in some clarity. Now, after that particular event, she didn't see the girl in the mirror again. But there were other things that did happen in where they lived. The TV would turn itself on and off. And when they moved to another location, of course, that stopped, so it wasn't the TV. They decided that perhaps the apartment had been haunted. Now, the apartments were fairly new, but 100 years ago, there were a few cabins sprinkled around the area, most of which were demolished long before any of us were even thought about. What was these long gone homes is buried between beneath asphalt and concrete and apartment buildings. You know, interestingly enough, it appears that spirit activity escalates on anniversaries and holidays. And it was suggested that perhaps the excitement generated by the first day of school may have been sufficient to allow her to appear. Now, this particular little girl first started having encounters when she was about 3 years old. She began talking to her parents about her grandmother. And her parents later told her she drove them crazy talking about her grandmother all the time. Now, since she had very little actual contact with her grandmothers on either side, her parents thought it was her imagination acting up. One day, she was about four, she was said, "Let's go to Grandma's house." And she kept on and she kept on and she kept on. And finally, the parents said, "Fine. Tell us where to go." She'd say, "Turn here and go down to the next block and turn here." And finally, ended up in an orchard. And her mother was getting disturbed because it dawned on her she'd been there before. And even though that land was now vacant, she had visited a house there long before she'd gotten married. She'd been just a child herself. When her family went to visit an elderly woman who lived in a house adjacent to that orchard. That appeared to be the grandmother that the little girl was talking about. And what was interesting was after that trip to the orchard, the little girl never mentioned Grandma again. Now, one theory was that the spirit of that little old lady had gotten lost and found a familiar family. And to her surprise, only a little girl could see her. Now, you never really know when a child tells you stories of that type, if they're what they've really seen or their childish imagination. House I grew up in, original part was built in 1815. It started life as a large cabin that over 100 and some odd years before I came along, it became it looked very similar to Tara on the front with the two-story porch with the columns. And I was always seeing and hearing things. Of course, I was assured by a no-nonsense grandmother that I was just seeing things. And especially during storms, you'd hear footsteps walking around on the second floor. And I'm told that, I had imaginary friends. Don't remember them, but that's been a long, long time ago. Same grandnephew told his grandmother recently how to get back to the lake when she took a wrong turn on a maze of logging roads. Who told the four-year-old where to go? It's a good question. There were quite a number of... years ago, I had a lot of cousins and what have you. I was... the oldest grandchild, so I was always interested in listening to the old folks and their tales of yesteryear. And there were quite a number of stories about very strange occurrences. And perhaps that was one of the things that got me enthusiastically. Someone did. Either that or he had a pretty effective GPS. Now, there were always even in those days, wannabes, who try to enliven their somewhat dull life with stories of strange and unusual. My partner nearly got committed to the psych ward when he was a kid for hallucinations, just got medicated up for it instead. Well, you know, interestingly enough, when I was in South America, I came back with an interesting condition that periodically mimics a heart attack. And it hit not too long, a year or so ago. And I wound up in so much pain I couldn't straighten up. We went to the hospital. And it was decided I needed morphine. Now, I'd never had morphine before, because of my injuries that were serious enough, we weren't anywhere near where they had morphine. So I got shot up, and I was seeing all kinds of things. In fact, I saw a lady in a blue dress come into my hospital room and sit down and tell me stories. I mean, it was an interesting occurrence. And of course, no doubt in my mind that at another date and another time, hallucinations, I guess you could say, might have been considered odd. No doubt in my mind that all of those things that I was seeing couldn't be just made up by my mind. And some of the things that I saw happen, especially in regard to one particular nurse, if I could have got it on film, I'd never have to work again. And, of course, I never told her what I was seeing, but it was definitely, in fact, they asked me, is there anything they could do to make me more comfortable? And I said, more morphine, please. They didn't comply. In fact, my wife walked in and watched what was going on, and she told him I was having too much fun. That had to stop. And so they're supposed to give me morphine, I think, every 2 or 3 hours. They removed that note from the chart, which I was very unhappy about. But you also have to wonder, hallucinations can be amusing at times. At other times, they can be downright baffling. But with children who have imaginary friends, you have to wonder how they can come up with information sometime that there's absolutely no way they could have ever have known. Especially information about dead relatives. Now, there are times, of course, that someone may have mentioned it in the child's hearing and the child just remembered it. That is not beyond the realm of possibility. But sometimes there's information that even some of the family doesn't know. So I got hurt when I was in the military. I'm 100% disabled. If it could be broken, I made a strong effort to get it done. And now I'm paying for it. Walk with a cane. Which is interesting. Project Montauk used LSD on the troops. Yes, it did. In fact, I've been up in the Montauk area. I didn't get to Camp Hero, which is the military base underneath which the caverns exist. We lived in New York City for several years. Wish I could have gotten the opportunity to go explore, because my ID card will still give me in almost any place I want to go. But there are stories told about the area underneath Camp Hero. It's also interesting to and to keep in mind, it's supposedly decommissioned right after World War I, I think it was. And yet, there are guards still, when there's no rational reason to have guards. Now, Montauk is also where the giant gorilla is supposed to have appeared, created by a machine that they were experimenting with. Talking about the New York City underworld, in fact, their second and third generation families living in the tunnels underneath New York City. Underneath the Waldorf Astoria, there is a, who was it? The Rockefellers, I think it was, the Vanderbilts, had their own private subway station that was decorated with great works of art. I mean, it's supposed to be beautifully designed, but it's been sealed up for 60 or 70 years. Castar 66 says she heard something about the Denver airport. Is it true there are tunnels underneath it? According to what I have been told, the Denver airport was built at a time Denver didn't need a new airport, number one, and number two, it was well outside the confines of the city of Denver. Nobody really understood everything about the design. I don't think anybody really knows for sure who designed it. If you go inside, there are murals showing children in coffins. There's supposed to be multiple layers of tunnels underneath the airport, and they run for miles and miles. And there are many, many stories about people actually disappearing in the Denver airport. Now, of course, with stories like that, you never know whether or not to believe them, but there are many, many people who swear that it's a place where if you are one of those who is less than a friend to the government, you may not ever walk out of the Denver airport. I've heard many, many bizarre tales about the airport. Some of the symbols inside the airport are purely Masonic. Some seem to be symbols of that are associated with the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati of the 1700s. And if you ask questions of the city of Denver, they tell you they're not in control. I've had a number of people ask me to do a book about the Denver airport. And frankly, here in El Paso, I'm not that far from it, but that's one topic I haven't gotten around to talking about much. I've invited people who supposedly are experts on it to come on the show, but thus far no one's taken me up on it. You would think they would want to talk about their pet project at great length, but thus far, no. Okay, we have gone through the first hour, which is brought to you by Marcello's, Ristorante Italiano. Two locations, 1360 Lee Trevino in the Sun Point Shopping Center, 5380 North Mesa in the Festival Crossing Shopping Center. Both are a slice of old Italy set down in the desert southwest. And if you like Italian food, you have to go there. You need to make a special trip to El Paso to go there. And if you go, tell him you heard about it on the Ken Hudnall Show, and I'll appreciate it greatly. Okay, that being said, let us get our second hour guest on the show. All right. Let me see if the phone will cooperate.
What's going on?
Well, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. We're on now, or?
We're on right now.
Oh, okay. Well, good evening.
So, before we get started, any overall predictions for the next 60 days?
Well, on the international scene, yeah, there's a lot of things. I think we may see some activity in the Middle East dealing with Israel and Iran. There might be some military action taking place. We've talked about this for about the last 8-9 months, and
yep,
we kind of narrowed it down to April or August, and so August is here, and if you've been reading any of the latest news reports, apparently Iran is going to go to the next stage of its nuclear plan, and we'll just wait and see if the Israelis allow it to happen. I kind of think that they won't, so let's just see what the next 10, 11 days hold. You know, at the beginning of the year also we had mentioned that there would be a lot of things occurring geographically,
mm-hmm,
earthquakes, floods, things of that nature. And we started off with Haiti. The earthquake in January claimed almost 200,000 lives. And, you know, even in your home state of Tennessee, Ken, I think they called it the flood of the century.
Yeah, they did.
So we've been seeing a lot of that stuff, and right now in Pakistan, a couple of million people are homeless. So the predictions that we made at the beginning, you know, seem to be coming to pass. Dealing with man-made type of thing. Well, not man-made, but things that are just part of geographic destiny.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of calamities occurring, and that has been the case for about the last 9 months throughout the world. Earthquakes, floods, you know, a lot of people are getting taken up in these events. I don't particularly pick up any type of terrorist activity going on the next couple of months. I just don't see it. I think it's just going to be a lot of Mother Nature belching and coughing, and that'll probably take us up through the end of the year. Now, there was one thing that had been brought to my attention on quite a few occasions. I've mentioned that I just didn't see Fidel Castro or Osama bin Laden being around, and all of a sudden, you know, Fidel Castro appeared and, you know, making some personal presentations. But as far as Cuba goes, you know, these guys are capable of just about anything. And
yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if this guy is an imposter. You know, one of the details about that is when Castro gave a speech about 2 or 3 weeks ago. You know, his speech only lasted like about 5 or 10 minutes. And, you know, if he would have gone on for about 6 hours, then I would have probably said, well, I guess I made a mistake and he's no longer here. But I just don't see the guy as being around. And Osama bin Laden, I think the guy's history also. But those are just some of the things that we've seen. The one thing that I'm really concerned about is the economy. It's going to go south. The stock market's been taking a lot of hits. I think it took about a 2% hit today.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been pretty accurate with the stock market over the last, actually, about the last 10, 12 years. Back in 1999, when we were going into the new millennium, we predicted that the stock market would hit 10,000, 11,000, 12,000, go up in that area, and it did hit those peaks, but then it did come down again. So that roller coaster will continue. It's going to be taking some hits, and unemployment again, probably 9.5, 10%, 14, 15% in other parts of the country, and it's just going to be economics. So a lot of gloom here. But
yeah.
Anyway, we got only got 4 more months till the new year. Hopefully, that'll bring some more light. The other things that we talked about previously is the deployment of 30,000 combat troops to Fort Bliss, part of the BRAC realignment, but actually probably more to secure the southern border. And as we all know, the violence in Mexico is ongoing, continuous. I think over the weekend, this weekend, 71 people were murdered in Juarez, and it's just not going to stop. You know, it's the beginning of the Civil War. If anybody looks at these things very carefully, you'll notice about a week ago, that there was some infighting with the Mexican Federal Police. Some rank-and-file officers accused their commanders of being in cahoots with the drug cartels and actually got a hold of them, were socking them around and knocking them on their butts. And, and 4 of the commanders were apprehended and sent off to Mexico City for nothing, really. I mean, those guys will probably be out on the street the next day.
Yeah.
So those are the things that we're looking at, and I keep mentioning too the one issue about immigration reform is it's a joke. Immigration reform is a joke. And the thing about any type of immigration reform is that nobody plays by the rules. You know, they signed the 1986 Immigration Reform Act, Simpson-Mazzoli bill, more commonly known as, and nobody played by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Illegals kept coming in, immigration wasn't allowed to enforce the laws, employers kept hiring cheap labor, and what makes anybody think that anything is going to happen with new immigration reform is just, it's just to appease all the people that are being vocal about it, that's all it is. There's never going to be any changes with immigration. Where there's a will, there's a way. And one of the things connected with what I mentioned about Mexico with the revolution is if you think we have an immigration problem now, wait till you have 50,000 people at the border rushing the bridges, or 100,000 people fleeing Mexico trying to come into the United States to avoid the violence.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do when 25,000 people rush a border crossing facility? You're going to set up machine gun nests or claymore mines? I don't think so. So those are things that are going to be happening, and nobody seems to be, you know, we Americans, we wait till there's a Pearl Harbor or the Maine or some type of calamity before we take action. We don't prepare.
Well, it's not the last minute yet.
I'm sorry?
It's not the last minute yet.
Well, it's not, but, you know, anybody making any types of contingency plans? I don't think so.
I've got 3 sandbags here.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a start.
Yep.
You know, 55% of the illegal population in the United States has come here legally. So what are you going to do about the person that comes over from England to go visit the Big Apple and then just decides to stay? Or the Russian family that comes in to go see Disneyland and they decide to stay? You know, they just overstay their visa. You know, and that's 55% of the problem. That doesn't necessarily mean securing the borders, building a fence, putting more border patrol agents. That's only part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to do about the ones that overstay their visa? That's what they need to focus in on.
Well, they won't do that because, like, Harry Reid is counting on a lot of those folks putting him back in office.
Well, yeah, that's right. You know, and well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You know, we Americans, the country is a very generous country. We have the best, the most liberal immigration policies, and yet people still aren't happy. But you know, that's not what I do. I predict what's going to happen, and that's essentially what I'm telling you, is that one of these days there's going to be people crossing the border en masse. If you seal up the border and there's no place to cross, and the only place is a port of entry or a certain focal point, people will gather there by the hundreds or the thousands. And people will escape tyranny, will escape violence.
Yeah. I agree.
Anyway, so those are some of the things that are on the table. Do we have any callers in the chat room or anything, Ken?
We got a bunch of people in the chat room. They're just listening. One has said she's started putting up food storage, so she's getting ready based on what you had to say.
Well, I'm looking at around 2012 for the big push in Mexico. Mexico is coming up for its 200th Independence Day on the 16th of September this year.
Mm-hmm.
And again, historically, if you look at the calendar, you'll see at 1810, 1910, and also 2010 will be focal points for changes in Mexican policy or political policy. And like I mentioned, those those police, those federal police that turned on each other, you know, and you had 300 or 400 Mexican federal police standing off against each other. All you needed was some trigger-happy guy to open up, and there would have been a bloodbath. You would have had a lot of casualties.
That's right.
And that's how it's going to start. Then you bring out the army. You bring out the army to quell the violence, and the Mexican federal police turns on the army, and there's the beginning. There's the beginning of your civil war. Look at what happened the last 2 days in Mexico. A mayor of a city was kidnapped and killed. Army convoys are being ambushed. You know, people are being massacred. They're being kidnapped. Heads are rolling, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to, the only way to stop all of this is going to have to be through some type of a possibly even a totalitarian regime, where, you know, you get the consequences of you being involved in any type of corruption will be very, very severe. There's too many individuals that have their hand in the till, and it goes all the way up to the highest levels of government. And the only way that you can take them out is through some type of a revolution.
Well, it's always been a strong man in Mexico.
Well, there's always been a strong man historically in most Latin American countries. You know, they like to be slapped in the face, told what to do, and a lot of countries have very, very liberal constitutions. I mean, you read their constitution, and it's probably better worded than our constitution, with more rights towards individuals and freedoms. But the thing about it is it implemented?
Yeah.
Is it only for show? That's where it comes in.
Well, most of it's only for show. I mean, it's not.
There's
always somebody can always figure out a way to make a profit.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's probably mostly for show than it is for anything else.
Yep. There's a question in the chat room from Carla. Should she pursue a romantic relationship with Frank?
Well, if Carla and Frank, so it sounds like Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I don't know. Give me some details here. Give me some birth dates, if you will. Give me.
How about a birth date for you and Frank? She's being a little quiet on the birth dates here.
Also, have her select a number between 1 and 100. And also, where is she calling from?
She's calling from Canada. She says Frank is a Scorpio dragon. She's a Taurus rat, so she's born in May, and he's born in... I don't know what Scorpio is.
Well, it could be October or November.
October 27th, 1964, I assume that is Carla. And...
Well, let's find out. Yeah, you know, if Carla is October the 27th, we need to find out who she dumped. Because apparently she severed a relationship with somebody.
And her number is 47, and Frank's birth date is May 11th, 1960.
Yeah. Well, we need to find out who Carla dumped. Apparently... she must have turned her back on somebody. I don't know if this was recently or in the immediate past. Also, I've got
them reversed. Carla is May 11th, 1960. Frank is October 27th, 1964.
All right, well, then Frank must have just gotten dumped. Apparently, he must be on the rebound. I kind of suspect peripherally that Carla might be kind of afraid to be involved in another relationship. She may be afraid to make a commitment. And I think that Frank probably just got dumped recently. I don't know. If I were Carla, I might maybe hold off for a while. We need to find out about what I just got through mentioning.
He did a while back.
I say again?
He did a while back. He got dumped.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He got dumped, and she may be afraid of commitment right now. She may not want to get involved. Also, apparently Carla was also probably very devastated when she was a teenager or early 20s by somebody. Somebody really must have damaged her about the time she was in her late teens or early 20s. I don't know if she might be afraid of commitment. But it'd probably be a short-term relationship.
She said she had her heart smashed in June.
June of this year?
Uh-huh.
No. What about when she was a teenager, late teens or early 20s?
Carla, did you have a heartbreak in your late teens, early 20s? Not getting an answer right now. She was in an abusive relationship late teens.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She must have been in a pretty bad relationship when she was a teenager, and she might have been traumatized to the point where she may not want a commitment. But yeah, I get what the heck. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, only go.
I like the Scorpio might be good for her.
She had a boyfriend that battered her.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I kind of pick up that she may have had a real bad relationship.
She married, too.
Right. The marriage lasted, what, 6 months or a year?
She didn't say how long it lasted.
Oh, okay.
She said they were opposites.
Okay. Well, that's past history. Yeah, tell her to go for it. Yeah, the Scorpio might be good for her, actually. So let us know how it plays out.
13 years, whatever that is.
13 years. Well, she was married 13 years. Is that what she said?
Must be. She said a Taurus Scorpio opposites.
Yeah. Well, opposites do attract, don't they?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yep. Okay. Do you have any other questions in the chat room?
She was with her husband from 82 to 97. So that's almost 15 years.
Okay. Well, yeah, tell her to go for Frank Dad and see how it plays out.
Okay, do we have any other questions? She said bad marriage. Well, that happens.
Yeah, it happens.
Okay, Math Smith.
I'm sorry?
She made the comment, Math Smith. I guess she meant it didn't count.
Oh, okay.
But she's a good friend with her ex.
Well, good. Nice to meet you. Peace and home.
Hey, you do what you gotta do.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, do we have no earthquakes far west coast? I guess she wants to know if there's going to be any earthquakes in California.
Well, I think, before I had to take some time off from the program, we were making predictions about earthquakes pretty consistently, and
yep.
And there was an earthquake happening in some area of the world almost on a weekly basis.
Oh, she wants to know about British Columbia.
British Columbia.
Yeah.
You know, I don't necessarily pick up any activity up in Canada. Mostly, probably, I keep telling you about Kobe, Japan, and you know what? I did some research on that, and I found out that there was like about a 7.5, 8 point on the Richter scale in Kobe. I think it was around 1955 or somewhere around there. A lot of destruction and stuff, but I wasn't aware of that. But I'm still pointing to that. That particular area. California, yeah, we'll still have some stuff over there, but I don't pick up that it's going to be of a large magnitude. Just a regular 4 or 5 on a Richter scale.
Okay.
I'm trying to look at something. Again, at the beginning of the year, I kept mentioning that there was going to be, you know, a lot of natural disasters, and then of course Haiti was the following week, and here we are again in August again, and like we have what's going on in Pakistan right now. But 2010 is going to be a bad year for natural disasters. It's going to be a bad year, and something very interesting. Have you noticed how many hurricanes we've had?
Yeah.
How many have we had? We haven't had any, have we?
We've had tropical storms that haven't hit hurricane force yet.
That's right. That's right. We haven't had any major hurricanes. Okay? But the hurricanes, there's going to be minimal amount of hurricane activity, and what's going to take its place is going to be other natural disasters. Again, earthquakes, floods, things of that nature. We'll see how it plays out.
Weird weather.
I have the dubious distinction of having the same birthday as the day Katrina hit.
Well,
August the 29th, it's going to be a week from, I think, Sunday.
Well, if you can guarantee no earthquakes, no hurricanes, that'd be a great place to buy property. Prices are still down.
Well, again, we didn't actually make the prediction that there wasn't going to be any hurricanes, but it's going to be minimal. Like, I think what when Katrina hit, there was three or four major storms that hit, and then the activity hasn't been very significant, actually, the last couple of years.
Okay. Now, Cat Star asked a question, but that question has too much baggage on it. It has to do with something about the show. Just out of curiosity, I got approached by somebody who wanted to talk to me again about doing a TV show for cable. If I decided to do that, would it work?
Well, you know, Ken, I kind of suspect that you're just fulfilling your destiny with all of these things. You know, you started off with the written word, the printed word, and then you graduated onto radio, and then you've graduated onto international radio, and then you start having the video portion of it also.
Yeah.
So it's just a natural progression. That's all it is. So I would give it a thumbs up. It's just the next step on the way up. I would look into it, absolutely, and especially if you get some sponsors and start making some good money also. But it's just a natural progression. That's the way I see it.
Very good. Maybe I can even get my singing career started.
Well, that too. Why not? You're from Tennessee. You know, a lot of good country artists have come out of Tennessee.
That's right. Get me a tight white jumpsuit, and who knows what can happen.
There you go.
Okay. Say again?
Just like that individual, I forgot the guy's name, but the one that sold more records than Elvis Presley back in the 60s or 70s. Do you remember that guy's name? He was a country singer.
No, I don't.
They used to run his ads on TV all day long. No, I don't remember the guy's name. But anyway, what was your next question?
Carla said, eek. Well, just think of me in a tight white jumpsuit, unzipped down to my navel. We're ready for that next question. Anybody else wants to know what the future holds? I've only got Robert for another half hour, so we need to get the questions in. Well, I don't know.
Can you give out the phone number?
Yeah, I did right before I brought you on, but they're 915-219-4210. Toll free from any place in the continental United States, 866-229-2155 or 347-857-2680. Any of those numbers will get you on the Ken Hudnall Show, and you can find out from Robert McKnight what the future holds. Just a phone call away. Now, I've been playing the numbers you gave me for the lotto. Haven't won yet.
You haven't won anything?
$7.
Well, there you go. You see, you have won. How many numbers did you hit? Three?
Yes.
All right. Well, that's a start.
Yeah.
That's a start.
Carla wants to know... Now, her birth date was 5/11/60, and her number was 47. Will she get the operation she needs or some other way to heal her hernia?
Ooh, ay, ay, ay. Actually, you know what? I don't see an operation here with her. I don't see any scars with her. Is that set in stone now? Because I just don't. I don't pick up an operation. Has she been procrastinating about it for a while?
Carl, have you been putting off doing anything about it? She's disabled by it.
Well, yeah, but has she been putting it off, though?
Well, she hadn't responded to that yet, even though I asked it. Have you been putting off getting anything done about it? Yes, for 3 years.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I just don't see it getting done. You know, she's been putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, and nothing's happened here. So, well, it's her own choice. You know, it's her own choice. But I just don't see anything happening here. I don't pick up any scars or anything like that. I think that's what I'm trying to tell you.
Okie dokie. All right. Any other questions? Let me go back over here. Everything is still going.
I'm sorry?
I'm just mumbling to myself. I'm at the age where I tend to mumble. She sees a surgeon next week. She's afraid, been operated on many times.
Wow. Well, I mean, I don't know, Ken. You know, I don't see any particular scars on this thing happening, but I guess, you know, I'd go with the doctor's advice on that.
Okay. Okay, Catstar, you got any questions, or Gray Artist? We have, okay, let me see what we got here. You're on the Ken Hudnall Show.
Hey, what's going on, Ken? It's Bill.
Oh, just another exciting day in the city.
All right, that's awesome. I was wondering, could you make me a sandwich, you fat fuck? Nigger, 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 nigger.
Okay, we have the Lunatic Brigade has joined us. It's too bad you don't have the integrity of a to make it worthwhile having a conversation with you.
Yeah, I would have told you on that one, Ken, that was a caller we didn't want to take.
Yeah. Well, that's typical. They've shown their ignorance many, many times. They don't seem to...
That guy's called before, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, a Blog Talk has not done anything about the ignorance. Carla wants to know, will the Vancouver Canucks ever win the Stanley Cup?
Wow.
Or is that just hoping for a miracle?
Oof. Gosh, you know, Ken, I don't know if I could even comment on that. I'm not into that. You know what, I tell you what, why don't we do this? Let's ask the question next week and let me do some stuff with that and work on that. I just couldn't tell you. I don't know too much about it.
Okay, I've got another caller, Jake from Ohio. Any point in answering that call?
It's from Jake from Ohio?
Yep.
What's the gentleman's birthday?
Well, I don't know. He's calling wanting to come on. Is that going to be one of the idiots, or is that a legitimate call?
You know what? I think I would pass on this one, Ken, actually.
Okay, then that's exactly what I shall do. But that shows, since he's not in the chat room, there's a hell of a lot of people listening. Okay, any other caller? Or anybody else that has a question for Robert? Because I only have him for another little while.
Are you there?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. I thought I'd lost you.
Oh, no, I'm here. I was just checking to see if anybody had any questions in the chat room.
Have we gotten any response to some of the predictions that I've made in the past or even today? Any comments, thoughts?
Not yet. I think they listen and they acknowledge and then they wait to see. I just had a local call to call in, and when I went to answer it, they hung up. That's too bad. Local calls are usually legitimate.
Okay. Have you had any interesting individuals come out on the show for interviews or whatever?
Yeah, I've had, here we go. We've got another caller. Let me see about this one, and I'll answer that question. I come back. You don't get hurt, go.
Nigger, 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 sandwich, sandwich, make me a sandwich, you nigger.
Okay. Yeah, I'm here. Another ignorant individual that tries to show his intelligence. And I don't know what they're proving. Because all I do is throw them off the air, and that's it.
Don't you have a 5-second time delay?
I have a delay. It's not that long.
Yeah. Is there any way to incorporate like a 5-second time delay?
I think it's... I guess it is 5 seconds. A number of people have told me about the delay. That's why they're slow responding. When I ask a question, it takes them a few seconds to respond. Gray Artist wants to know where you're from. El Paso, Texas, of course. Carla said it's way past Ignoramus's bedtime. Well, that's true. Unfortunately, they don't have adult supervision. And they think obscenities make them big men. That's kind of like the local yo-yo who couldn't be a big man if he stood on a box. Tarot Card Reader 101 wants to know, have you ever heard of the wild mudkip tribes from Africa?
No, Robert? But I've heard of the Pasades from through the Philippines. Not that particular. No, I haven't. Why? What's up with that group?
Not a clue. If I'm not mistaken, that is part of the idiocy that I've dealt with in the past.
All right.
Okay, we have another caller. I don't know whether to answer it or not, but we'll give it a shot.
Give me the name.
It's just a phone number.
No.
You're on the Ken Hudnall Show.
Hey, Candace.
Yes?
I actually want to talk about the wild tip because I'm a tarot reader right there. I'm on your chat, man.
Yeah, you're echoing real bad. It's hard to understand you.
Yeah, my phone is kind of really bad. Hold up a minute. I think my mom's making me a sandwich.
That's another idiot. So we'll just let that one ride. I'm sorry about this, Robert. They only pop up on days when there's a lot of calling activity, and there's no excuse for it. We have a local number. You're on the Ken Hudnall Show.
How's it going? I'm from El Paso, Texas. I'm going to come over and get my sandwich, you nigger, nigger, nigger.
You
nigger,
come
nigger.
On over, and we have something in El Paso called the Castle Doctrine, and I'll explain it to you. That's, I guess I'm going to have to end the calls for tonight because we don't have any adults who have telephones. It's all children.
All right. Okay, that's fine.
Well, I tell you what, since we do have about 20 minutes left, let me ask you a couple of questions. I saw the last combat unit was pulled out of Iraq yesterday or today. What kind of impact is that going to have on what's going on in the Middle East? Because that's certainly a flashpoint.
Well, Ken, the bottom line is those individuals over there, you hit the nail on the head a little bit earlier when you talked about strong men or dictators or whatever. You hit the nail on the head. You know, those guys will eventually wind up with someone in power. There'll be a power struggle. They'll kill each other off, and the survival of the fittest, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And, we talk about democracy and stuff like that. It's not going to happen over there. It's not going to happen. Those guys don't know anything about that. They're not freedom-loving individuals, as soon as we leave Afghanistan, you know as well as I do what's going to happen.
Now, of course.
These guys are just going to wait until the last U.S. troops have left, and then they're going to go and get all the weapons they've been storing, and they're going to come out, and whoever is the strongest of all the elements, of all the tribal lords or whatever, is the one's going to take over. And, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we'll be in the same situation. When they had the Shah of Iran, that guy Riz, of course, he was very pro-Western and everything, but, eventually they overthrew the guy and they put in those Ayatollahs and these individuals, that's all they know, a dictator is going to go right wing or left wing, doesn't make any difference. They just want somebody to make some decisions that are unchallengeable.
Yeah.
And
Robert, we have a legitimate call on the line who would like to get a reading from you. This is Gray Artist. Are you there?
Yes.
How are you? Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm good. My
Hello.
Name's Carol, my real name.
What's that?
I'm sorry, what?
My real name's Carol.
Well, how are you, Carol?
I'm good. I just wanted to call and show you there's some real sane people who are listening.
I appreciate that.
Cool. And
Carol,
I was wondering,
what did you...
Excuse me?
Go ahead.
I was wondering
okay,
if you, what you thought the upcoming elections, which way they were going to turn.
Well, looking into the crystal ball, I kind of suspect that the Republicans are going to pick up anywhere from maybe 20 to 30 seats. And the House may pick up 5 to 7 in the Senate. Things are going to swing the other way, that's for sure. Obama will be a one-term president. There's no doubts about that. And, you know, it's really interesting also. Some of the things that I predicted about Obama when I did his handwriting was that the guy had some issues dealing with addictions. And I specifically mentioned two addictions was smoking and also alcohol. And if you recall, he was given his physical back around February or March, and two of the recommendations from the doctors were that he quit smoking and quit drinking. So that was kind of a validation on the prediction that I had made about him a year earlier. He does have quite a number of addictions, and he fights those almost on a daily basis. Yeah. I wouldn't doubt if he when he has a private moment, he goes into a closet, smokes one or two cigarettes, and of course you'll never see him doing it in public.
Mm.
But I think he'll be a one-term president.
Yeah. Something to look forward to. I don't think he'll have a chance of turning back a lot of the things he's done, though, as far as...
It'll probably be very difficult. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it'll probably be difficult to overturn the health issue. The Obama health plan is probably going to be very difficult to overturn that. Yeah, you're right. But it's good in a certain respect because, you know, we Americans, I guess, need to come to terms with the policies of individuals that are probably not good for the U.S., just like after Jimmy Carter. You know, what a disaster that was.
Oh, yeah.
And then he wound up being a one-term president. And so I kind of suspect that Obama, you know, his numbers are way down now in the polls. And, you know, he didn't have a clue. He doesn't have a clue of if he's coming or going. He just doesn't know how to handle it. You know, doesn't know how to handle the office. But anyway, I'll make a prediction that the Republicans make significant gains in the Congress, the House, and probably pick up about 5 to 8 in the Senate.
Okay.
So,
thanks, Robert. I appreciate it.
All right, so, and good luck on the House, too.
Okay. All right, well, I'm
going to
hang up now and listen some more. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you coming. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Well, it's nice to know there are some adults out there. The children
Absolutely.
Seem to be running rampant tonight.
Absolutely.
And it's they're so silly in what they're doing that you can't even get mad at them. It's more like it's pitiful. But this is their fun and excitement.
Yeah, there's a lot of sick people out there, Ken.
Okay. We got any more questions out of the chat room? And what's funny is when they don't get their way, they leave in disgust. Tarot Card Reader 101, who was another one of these clowns, when I knocked him off for his stupidity about the sandwich, also left. Okay. We're waiting on that next caller. If somebody, or they can come in through the chat room. I think we've about had it with callers for the evening. It's sad that this group gets together and plans their little activities, and that seems to be the high point of their day. And the one here in El Paso, I invite you to come see me. Let's see. Carla says, when you don't give an audience, they have no one to play with. That's true. Absolutely true. And what it does, though, is it drives away a lot of folks who come to listen. And you can't blame them because these folks try to dominate.
What's going to be the topic for your last hour, Ken?
I'm going to talk about haunted locations.
Oh, okay.
All over the country.
No, that would be interesting.
Yeah. And, just see. Normally I'd invite people to come on board and take part, but unfortunately the loons are out, so there's not that's kind of self-defeating.
Right.
The first time I tuned in, it was a bad night of idiots. I almost didn't come back. Well, I'm glad you did. Unfortunately, there's no way that we can control when they're let out of their room at the home or they don't take their medication. We have no way to know. And, some nights are extremely bad. There's no question about it. So, all we can do is the best we can do.
Absolutely, that's right. Okay.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes left. No other questions in the chat room. We got a couple of minutes left. Any other warnings that you want to give the people?
Say again, Ken.
We got a couple of minutes left. Any other warnings you want to give the people?
Well, I've mentioned that there's been sort of a little dark cloud hanging around for a few months that's affected probably a lot of individuals in finances, relationships, health issues. But the cloud seems to be going away probably around the end of August, early September, especially in the again, it's on an individual, not on a collective thing. Finances. I had a lady recently that had consulted with me on a business, and she was toying with the idea of filing for bankruptcy, that a business had really taken a beating. And this was back around January, February, and I told her, well, you know what, if you can hold out till the summer, and especially around the latter part of August and September, you're probably going to be doing pretty good and things will come back. And I got a call from her about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and she hung on, and she says she's doing a lot better now. She's getting a lot of more business, and, she's in the medical field, and she says that the checks are coming in from the different, insurance carriers, and she's real happy that the business has taken a turn for the better. So, these individuals out there have had some strong financial setbacks. I'd hang around for another short period of while. There should be a lot of good news happening. Individual, but again, collectively, it could be a different story.
Okay. Well, it would. A lot of folks I know are having you know, considerable problems. So it's nice to know there could well be a silver lining.
Yeah, there is. It has to balance out.
I used to think that, but quite a bit of evidence to the contrary, though.
Right.
So the you gonna be back with us routinely now?
Well, hopefully, yeah. You know, I was out on an extended sabbatical, and hopefully everything will come out all right. But I'll keep you posted and let you know, Ken.
Okay.
It's actually on almost a day by day situation.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly understandable. But, you know, your appearance certainly adds a lot to the show.
Well, I appreciate you. I've had a good run throughout the years, and, you know, there's good chemistry between us, and so that's cool. So I look forward to it.
Now, if we can just figure out when I'm supposed to win the lottery, you know, I'll be ecstatic.
Well, keep on trucking. You never know.
And that's true. It's the one I want to win is the Mega, which is $100 million Friday night.
Well,
and that'd be almost enough to make this show successful.
Well, hopefully you'll win then if it's meant to be.
Well, let's not go there. Let's just say I'm going to win.
All right, you're going to win. We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Okie dokie. Well, I appreciate you being with me. I know you got other commitments tonight.
All right, well, we'll see you next week then, Ken. Thanks a lot for the invitation.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
All right, good night.
Well, folks, I apologize for the loonies. Unfortunately, this is an organized group, and this is what they do for entertainment. Apparently, they are underemployed. They got too much in the way of computer skills, and they don't have any adult supervision. So, you know, you try to do a show that entertains, and this is what you get. And the local one would not surprise me at all if Mini-Me had something to do with that. Okay, for the next hour, and this past hour is brought to you by The Garden, 511 Western. A very eclectic Gray Artist says, I hope you do a show on the possibility of ancient gods being real people from history. Example. Actually, I think you're probably right. I did a book called UFO Secret Society and Ancient Gods, where that was the very concept I wrote about. And there's quite a bit of evidence supporting that concept. All right, we were last night, we were talking about some haunted lighthouses, and I got a few more. Now, let's see. I'm having to juggle a whole bunch of different screens here tonight, so you got to bear with me just for a moment. All right. Everything seems to be moving okay. In New London Harbor, which is in Connecticut, there is a lighthouse. It's called the New London Ledge Lighthouse. It's built out in the harbor. You only get to it by boat. You look up my book. I will greatly appreciate that. My new fulfillment company has not got their everything in place yet. But if you do decide to place an order through the website, send me an email, because I actually have some of them here, and normally I don't. Now, most lighthouses were built of cast iron, but the New London Ledge Lighthouse was built from brick. It was meant to look similar to the homes along the shore of Connecticut's New London Harbor. It was a man-made island constructed on a concrete base, and this was done back in 1909, so it was quite advanced for its time. Now, even though it was given all the amenities that could be given, a lot of the lighthouse keepers didn't enjoy being sort of isolated. Now, when the U.S. Coast Guard took over the lighthouse in 1939, they changed the schedule. They had three men on duty for 3 weeks at a time, and then they would get a 6-day shore leave. The theory was that if two of the men got into a fight during the 3 weeks they were on watch, the third man was there to break it up. But according to some, the New London Ledge Lighthouse also came complete with a ghost. Now, his name's supposed to be Ernie, and he's made his presence known by closing and opening doors, turning off TVs, and even mopping the floor. Others say that he's the cause of the foghorn sounding off at odd times and untying docked boats and setting them adrift. According to the story, Ernie was a lighthouse keeper sometime in the 1920s. And while he was excellent at keeping that light burning, he couldn't manage to keep his wife, who ran off with the captain of the Block Island Ferry. And he was so heartbroken and distraught that he committed suicide by jumping off the roof of the lighthouse. Now, there was a lighthouse expert, an author, who spent a night at the lighthouse in August of 06 with a couple of other folks of the New England Ghost Project. Everybody's got a project, you know. Everybody's got a team. Now, one of the people was a trance medium who's been doing it more than 25 years. And she's also been doing paranormal investigations for quite some time. Done more than 100 ghost hunts. And on that particular night, they set up recorders and other ghost hunting equipment. She began to channel the spirit of a man. Her demeanor was said to have changed completely into that of an angry, violent spirit. And at one point, she hit one of her companions, accusing him of, in a deep voice, very much unlike her own, of lying. Now, after several tense moments, she came back to herself and told her companions what she had experienced. According to what she said, the spirit was extremely angry about the story that was told about the lighthouse keeper killing himself because it was actually a cover-up for a prank gone afoul. The spirit was that of a former worker at the lighthouse who slipped and fell to his death after his fellow crew members played a joke on him by locking him out on the wet roof of the lighthouse. And in trying to get back in, he slipped and fell to his death, and the whole thing was hushed up. And being a somewhat vengeful ghost, that may have been the reason a number of lighthouse keepers actually quit. In fact, the last entry in the lighthouse log, written in 1987 by a Coast Guard individual working for the Coast Guard mining the lighthouse, was a bit of a poem. Rock of slow torture, Ernie's domain. Hell on earth, may New London's ledge light shine on forever, because I'm through. I'll watch it from afar while drinking a brew. More than one murder, I guess you could say, has been covered up by being cast as a suicide. Certainly, that's possible. The Hesada Head Lighthouse in Yachts, Oregon. According to the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, which has taken it over, they are adamant it is not haunted. And they want people to understand that it's not haunted. But the lighthouse keeper's house, on the other hand, seems to be a different story. Originally, it stood right by the lighthouse before it was moved to its current location in 1939. The U.S. Forest Service now owns that particular building, and it serves as a center offering free tours to the public. And it's also been leased out as a bed and breakfast since 95. And whether you just take a tour or you stay in the bed and breakfast, the current co-owner of the bed and breakfast will be the first one to advise you to keep an eye out for a ghostly resident that's referred to as the Gray Lady. Now, research done on the building didn't turn up any stories of hauntings prior to 1970, when Lane Community College took over the lighthouse keeper's house as a satellite campus. The house was a duplex. And when the college removed the wall between the two dining rooms, it looks like they woke something up. Now, remember, we've discussed before that changes to buildings quite often wake up something. Renovations get spirits active. They don't like change. You put in some drunk college kids, and Lord help us, stories start. Now, there's no definitive proof that a young lady by the name of Rue, which is supposed to be the name of the Gray Lady, ever lived in that house. But the resident records weren't carefully kept the first decade of who lived in that house. And she might have lived there between 1894 and 1904. The lighthouse first began its operation in 1894, and most lighthouse keepers had wives. Now, the first story about Rue was found in a 1975 newspaper article, which began with the story of a man hanging insulation in the attic one evening. He was alone. When he took a break and looked out a window, because it was getting a little darker outside and he had a light on in the attic, there was a reflection that appeared in the glass. And not knowing what it was, he turned to look and saw a lady with gray hair wearing a long flowing dress floating toward him. He was terrified, frozen in the spot where he stood. And he didn't move. Oh, gray artist, sorry to see you go. As she floated through him. But at that point, he decided to get the hell out of the house, leaving all his tools behind. Once he got to town, he kind of rationalized in his own mind why he needed to go back, because there was still work to be done on the outside of the house, and he'd never heard of a ghost haunting the outside of a building. So, what happened to Carla? She went bye-bye. So he went back the next day and put a ladder up against the side of the house, and he was working near a window when he saw the gray lady again floating toward him just like she did before. He was in such a hurry to get down the ladder, he actually broke a window pane in the attic window. And when he finally got off the ladder, he ran back to town and never set foot there again. Well, the lighthouse keepers came home late, the caretakers for the lighthouse keeper's house came home late and went to bed, and don't know if they knew that the window had been broken or not, but they awoke to hear the sound of glass being swept in the attic. Now, they knew they were the only ones in the house, and they didn't quite know what to make of it, so they waited till daylight when they went up into the attic, and the glass from that broken window had been swept up into a little pile. Now, the story was too good to keep to themselves. It wound up being told within earshot of a local reporter, and eventually Associated Press picked it up. And finally, it made the big time. The November 1980 issue of Life magazine, in an article entitled Terrifying Tales of Nine Haunted Houses. And it's been known as a haunted house ever since. Now, the current co-owner of the Bed and Breakfast has been quoted as saying he's not really in the ghost, but and he kind of takes the gray lady in stride. And he's one of those types that no matter what happens, he tries to find a rational explanation. Sometimes it's hard. He's been there 7 years, and has alternated between staying in various rooms, and he's had some interesting experience. Now, most of the ghostly happenings seem to appear on the side of the house that was basically overseen by the first assistant lighthouse keeper. There's one room in particular. It's known as Victoria's room. Now, the co-owner and his wife, to repeat one of the stories that he told, closed the bed and breakfast for a few days so they could go on a vacation to someplace else. When they got back, they opened up the rooms to air them out, because you've got a building like that that you shut up, even for a few days, the air becomes stagnant. And they walked into Victoria's room, and they were almost knocked over by the smell of old-fashioned lavender perfume. They said it was so strong that it was like the woman had taken a bath in it. And that room also tends to heat up for no reason. And there's been quite a bit of proof about the fact that there's something else in that room that has shown up on the bed. Now, this young man, had he ever been to a military school, would have learned how to make hospital corners and be able to bounce a quarter off the bed. He had to be taught by his mother-in-law, which had to be, I don't recommend it. Well, one day he made the bed in Victoria's room and went into an adjoining room to straighten it up, and when he came back, he passed through Victoria's room for something else and noticed an indentation as if someone had sat on the bed. At first, he thought one of his co-workers or maybe his wife had been playing a trick, and he stepped out of the room to see who else was there, and there was nobody else on the floor but him. He said these type of things happen in Victoria's room. They've happened to him about a half dozen times. And things that happen in her room tend to come in bunches, and then they'll stop for a while. Now, once guests check in and kind of get the lay of the land of the bed and breakfast, they have the run of the house until the innkeepers provide a 7-course breakfast the next morning. And it's at that meal that the guests get a chance to socialize and share whatever encounters they've had the previous evening. And in fact, there's a ghost log that's kept that reports all the unusual happenings. Former students from when it was part of the college campus have come to stay, and they've mentioned frequent coastal power outages that happened in the 70s. And they said people would drive up the coast, and when they got close to the house, even though the power would be out all up and down the coast, there'd be a light in the attic, even though there's no electricity going to the house. A couple of people even decided to investigate, and they quietly went up the steps and shoved open the door, and the moment they did, the light in the attic would go out. If you ever get the opportunity to go up into Yachts, Oregon, you might step by and see what you find at the lighthouse keeper's house. Be a lot of fun. Now let's go to the other end of the country for a moment. About as far from Yachts, Oregon as you can. Let's go to St. Augustine, Florida. You know, there used to be lighthouses on every coast, and quite a number of them have reputations of being haunted. Now, this is the St. Augustine Lighthouse and Museum. And like many of them, they that are no longer in full operation. There's a museum attached to it. Now, St. Augustine, Florida has gained quite a reputation as a spooky location since it was founded in 1565. And according to those who buy lighthouses, anybody's guess. Now, this lighthouse sits on Anastasia Island. Well, it's an interesting question to ask, why lighthouses being haunted, but each one seems to have a different reason. Now, this haunted lighthouse and museum in St. Augustine has been featured in quite a number of paranormal television documentaries. And in fact, many have said it outshines all the other ghostly places in St. Augustine. Now, it was built in 1874 directly across Matanzas Bay from the Castillo de San Marcos National Monument. And it was the last in a line of light towers dating back to the 1500s and supposedly in or around that lighthouse is a portal to the afterlife. And that's supposed to be one reason St. Augustine is just crawling with ghosts. Now, this particular lighthouse is 165 feet tall. And it's supposed to contain a number of ghosts, most of whom ended their lives within the tower or somewhere on the grounds. The most frequently seen ghost that's usually seen on a tower's catwalk is that of a little girl. She wears a blue dress and has a bow in her hair. And people who've been there at night have been startled by the sounds of children laughing and playing. Now, there have been mediums to go in to do seances, and they're pretty much agreed that there are three young girls. Now, if you look at the records from the time when the lighthouse was being built, the construction supervisor, whose name was Hezekiah Pitti, lived on the site with his wife and five children. And one July day in 1873, two of his children and a child from another family who were playing with a hand cart that was used to haul supplies up from the harbor. This was a hand cart that was set on rails and it would run back and forth between two stops. And I'm sure the children thought it was safe. But in their fun and games, which were a little bit on the careless side, the cart ran off the rails into the bay and all three drowned. Now, there's another ghost that smokes cigars. And most people believe that the cigar-smoking ghost is named Peter Rasmussen. He was a former lighthouse keeper. And although Rasmussen himself has not been seen, a number of visitors report smelling cigar smoke in the old fuel house and in the basement. And he used to be a very fussy man about cleanliness. Most lighthouse keepers were. Everything had to be spotless. because they could be inspected at any time. Now, historical records, which were kept fairly complete in St. Augustine, indicate that several people died in or near the lighthouse, including one lighthouse keeper by the name of Harn, who died in 1889, and the wife of another keeper died in 1894. Now, there was another lighthouse that stood close to that spot prior to the building of this lighthouse. And there were two deaths associated with that lighthouse. One in 1853, when lighthouse keeper John Carrera fell from the tower. And the other in 1859, when Joseph Andreu, who was painting the tower, slipped and fell. Now, you would think they would know that right before you hit the ground, jump up and you should be okay, but neither one did. Now, one of the groups that was investigating the lighthouse actually filmed a human figure on the steps, the spiral staircase that went to the top. And actually, they chased him. And when they got to the top, there was no one there. But on film, he showed up. Now, in lighthouses, of course, the stairs are the only way up or down. There are no elevators, never were, and there were none added. But don't forget, one of the things that is said about this lighthouse is there's a portal to the afterlife. You know, there's supposed to be a portal here in El Paso, somewhere within or beneath El Paso High School. And El Paso High School is the most haunted building in this town. You know, in my research, it's come to light that one of the most haunted structures in any location I've been has been an educational institution here, El Paso High School. Well, let's talk about Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Now, it was begun by a religious order known as the Marist Brothers. Not the Marx Brothers, the Morris Brothers. Maybe Minnie should get sucked. Well, maybe he should. In fact, I would help him through if given the opportunity. Now, this order was located primarily in France. And in fact, French religious orders have been responsible for the building of quite a number of schools in the Southwest. And its primary claim to fame was in the educational field in the 1800s. In the early 1900s, a group of brothers went to the Hudson Valley area in upstate New York, just outside the city of Poughkeepsie. Now, in 1905, after buying a good-sized piece of property, the brothers renamed the area St. Anne's Hermitage. And they set about preparing men for a life dedicated to prayer and good works. In fact, the Marist school motto was actually to pray and to work. There was nothing else in life but prayer and work. Now, over the next few years, more of the order arrived to help expand the hermitage, and more buildings were built, and finally in 1946, New York State officially granted a four-year charter to the brothers, establishing Marist College. It was 1968 when women were finally admitted to the college, and well, they were allowed to enroll in day classes. Now, today it's a 180-acre campus and has about 5,000 students. But few students know that at one point in time, there was apparently a cold-blooded killer that called that educational institution home. It was in 1975 that this story had its beginnings. A very attractive young lady, a freshman, by the name of Shelley Sperling, came to Morris College, and she was enjoying her freedom, having graduated from high school. She was off on her own. Now, she'd had a high school sweetheart all through high school. And, of course, he saw no reason for that to change, but she broke things off before leaving for Mars. She wanted her freedom. She wanted to try her wings. Now, shortly after classes began, he came to the campus and tried to reconcile. And she didn't want any part of it, which really pissed him off. He attacked his sweetheart with a brick and fractured her skull. Now, he, of course, was arrested and charged with felony assault, and as is the case with our legal system, released on bail. And though her skull was fractured, she was basically in decent shape. And she told campus security about the attack because she was afraid. And they assured her that they'd be watching for him. Well, one day, as the young lady and a friend of hers walked across campus to the cafeteria, the ex-boyfriend stepped out of the bushes right in the middle of the walking path. Well, she knew something was up, and she told her friend to run and took off running for the cafeteria. And he followed right behind her. Well, the two got into the cafeteria and made it into a small office where some of the employees were taking a break. There was a telephone, and she grabbed it and tried to call campus security, and of course the line was busy. And she was standing there listening to that infuriating busy signal when her ex-boyfriend stepped into the room, pulled a pistol, and fired. Everybody, of course, took off running, except her. Several other shots were heard by people as they left the cafeteria. Campus police finally got off the phone and got over there, and they roped off the area surrounding the cafeteria and tried to establish communications with the young man. They didn't really want to get a gunfight started, so they took their time. 2 hours later, having failed to establish communication and not seeing any movement from inside the cafeteria, and no clue as to what was going on, they decided to move in. As they entered the building, the first thing they saw was the body of the young lady lying in the entrance to the cafeteria's office. And a few minutes later, they located the young man. He was sitting nearby, looking at photographs of the young lady. They arrested him without incident. A few days later, her memorial service was held at the Morris College Chapel. Hundreds of students and faculty showed up. It was quite the social event, I understand. Her body was later buried at Ivandale Cemetery in Brewster, New York. The next year, her former boyfriend was found incompetent to stand trial and sent to the Mid-Hudson Psychiatric Center for evaluation. And then he was transferred to the Harlem Psychiatric Center in Dover, New York, where he is there even as we speak. Well, the young lady, while a student, and it wasn't a very long time that she was a student, lived on the third floor of Sheehan Hall, and it was the college's very first residence hall. And according to some of the students who live there today, she never left. A number of strange things have been seen inside the building, especially on the third floor. Toilets were flushed by themselves. Faucets turn on and off. Electronic devices such as TVs and stereos turn on and off, pretty much with a will of their own. And her ghost has even been known to play around with students' computers when no one else is around. And some of the residents sometimes wake in the middle of the night to the sounds of doors opening and slamming shut. But after a while, people begin to kind of take them for granted. And they began to rationalize that this was that young lady's spirits making the rounds, ensuring everybody was safely in their beds. So many people have reported seeing, hearing, or sensing that young lady's spirit that a former Morris College student created a small website reporting some of the encounters. And there was another building where she is sometimes seen. It was a novitiate, the Grotto of Our Lady of Sorrows. It's a memorial to students who passed away, and sometimes she's seen there. Now, the next location is in the state of Pennsylvania. A lot of ghosts seem to like Pennsylvania. Now, I'm sure every one of you has been to at least one theatrical performance that well, for lack of a better term, is a disaster. And in the parlance of the profession, the actors literally die on stage. Now, a few actors literally die in the real sense of the word. But there is a story told at Clarion University about an actor who literally died. Now, like many universities, it was originally begun as a religious institution. It was a Methodist seminary, founded in 1867. It became a teacher's college in 1887 and an undergraduate university later on. And one of the oldest buildings on campus that's still used today is Hart Chapel Auditorium. Now, for many years, it was the center of worship on the college campus, and it was also where they had assemblies and commencement ceremonies and any other type of gathering that needed to be held. Now, in the 1930s, there was a significant renovation that transformed it into a 400-seat auditorium, which is what it is today. And since that time, this auditorium has hosted theatrical and musical productions, guest speakers, film presentations, and quite a number of other events. And the one constant in each of these events has been William, the spirit that haunts Hart Chapel. Now, William's story began just like that of any other aspiring actor. Wanted a Broadway career on the professional stage. And he was so sure of his acceptance that he left home in Ohio in 1934 with a one-man show and a scrapbook full of clippings and reviews. And he was determined he was going to make it. Worked his way through the Ohio Valley, and he heard about the newly renovated Hart Chapel Auditorium and the fact that the school had a policy of introducing new cultural elements to the local community. So he booked a date and arrived in town in the fall of 1934, prepared for greatness. Well, whether it was a cause of a case of nerves or, well, nobody really knows why, but his solo performance didn't go quite as it was intended. In fact, the audience booed him so badly he fled the auditorium before finishing his act. Feeling his theatrical career had come to an end almost before it had started, he chose to end his life. He left his hotel room on Main Street in the middle of the night and managed to get into the auditorium through the locked side doors. Carrying a rope slung over his shoulder, he made it up to the balcony, crawled along a thick wooden crossbeam to where a light fixture was attached at the highest point of the roof. Well, he tied one end of the rope to the bracket supporting the light and made a noose out of the other end and put it around his neck and did the high dive off the beam. Well, he may have been a bad actor, but he was an even worse hangman. He made the rope too long. So rather than dying of asphyxiation or a broken neck as he had planned, he decapitated himself. His body fell into the seats below and his head fell on the wooden stage. Quite a number of stories are still told about the pools of blood discovered by auditorium personnel the next morning. You know, a beheaded body can make a hell of a mess. Well, in the 75 years or so since William took his plunge, there have been hundreds of other actors in museums and teachers and students who performed on that stage. Some probably as bad as William, and others who went on to bigger and better things. But it was only William that took the booing to heart and committed suicide. And that's why they believe his soul is trapped in the theater. Looking for the applause and death he couldn't get in life. And sometimes he makes his presence known in strange ways. If you go to that auditorium today, you can see the plaster repairs on the walls where that crossbeam from which he jumped was removed long ago. The strangest thing, though, is remnants of that large blood stain and on center stage where his head came to rest are still visible. In spite of repeated efforts to buff, sand, stain, paint, and even replace the wooden stage, and they did that twice, the blood stain reappears again and again. Now, it's believed that it's William who's been responsible for several poltergeist events in the auditorium. Usually, when someone is telling the story of William to visitors and prospective students and they don't tell it right. Auditorium and public safety personnel tell stories of lights switching on and off, of microphones and other equipment being moved from the stage to the balcony from one night to the next. Students attending class in the building have often reported seeing strange figures moving in the darkness of the balcony that surrounds three quarters of the auditorium. In the fall of 2007, it was believed William disrupted one class video presentation by cutting on the theatrical spotlight and leaving it burning for 20 minutes before turning it off. When they finally got the key to open up the lighting booth, of course there was no one there. They have no idea how that spotlight got turned on. The number of photographs taken there in 2007 revealed orbs and shadows and figures passing some of the windows. Audio recorders left in the stairwells have recorded footsteps, despite the fact the building was completely empty. And twice, people trying to investigate have asked questions, and tape recorders that were playing, hoping to get some EVPs, have heard ghostly voices shushing those asking the questions. Well, eventually you come to the point where you have to ask why a figure will continue to haunt a building like that long after their death. Is he still craving applause? Or is he somehow tied to that building, the place where he died? It was also the place where he had the greatest hopes for his future and his greatest disappointment, all rolled into one. If you ever get the opportunity to go, you might ask about William. Never know what you can find out. Now, Muncie, Indiana has quite a number of educational institutions. One of the best known is Ball State University. And one of the places on Ball State University is Elliott Hall. And Elliott Hall has a ghost. Well, Carla, I appreciate you being with me. It's always fun to have you on. Now, Ball State University was named for the Ball brothers, who were very, very wealthy industrials there in Muncie. And they funded many, many good works during their lifetime, to include the university. Now, it was built in 1938 as a tribute to Frank Ball's son, Frank Elliott Ball, who died in a plane crash in 36. And it's one of the oldest residence halls on the university campus. And it's a replica of the house that young Frank lived in while attending Princeton. And in spite of the, I guess you could say, the tragic origins of the building, it's not the ghost of Frank Ball that is known to be haunting the place. It's the spirit of a Ball State student who wanders the hallways of that building. Now, in the days following World War II, a young man by the name of William Schomburg was one of thousands of young men who returned to the States and went to college on the GI Bill. Now, by the time he got to Ball State, he was scarred, disfigured, and as many people are who have visible scars, something of a hermit. His girlfriend, who had waited for him to return, was horrified by what he looked like, so she rejected him. He became a loner, severely depressed, and eventually committed suicide in Elliott Hall's fourth floor library. And it said he still roams the hallway. Now, one of the recent, relatively recent residents of Elliott Hall, who didn't want his name used, encountered William's ghost during a holiday weekend. He awoke in the middle of the night, freezing, and was surprised to find his room's windows wide open. Now, he knew he had closed and locked the windows the night before, and the door as well. And he immediately got up to check the door, and it was locked. So he closed the windows and made sure they were locked this time and went to sleep. And he woke up a while later and the windows were standing wide open again. So knowing the story of William Schomburg, he asked him politely to please leave him alone. He had to get up early and go to work the next day. And that's one of the many stories that are told about the ghost of Elliot Hall. Well, excuse me. Well, we've come to the end of another show. I hope y'all enjoyed it. I'm sorry about the idiots who felt that they had to show their stupidity to the world. Until tomorrow night at 6, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying, have a truly great evening.